If your parts have more frequent flyer miles than your sales team, when tariff wars erupt, you're going to be in trouble. It's very cool to say, I'm a free trader, dude. I want free trade. The problem is the other side isn't doing it. And when the other side isn't doing it, it's not so cool. You're getting screwed. You have to have the home. You have to have the final tier of the supply chain for silicon. We don't make smartphones here. We don't build computers here anymore. We don't build laptops. We don't build a lot of small devices. The world had tariffs on the US. And that was another reason why a lot of our manufacturing just was siphoned out of here. Like, do we want to own humanoids? Do we want to own hardware as close to AI as possible? You know, what are the things that we ultimately want to own?
We have officially crossed a chasm, and we're accelerating towards the complete and utter destruction of what was and a rebirth of what is.
There's a strategy and a culture inside of Tesla that built them for this moment.
Okay, we have Jeff Lutz on with us again. Jeff is an amazing mind and amazing insight into the world of supply chain. He has been in this game for a really long time. And the reason why it's so great to have someone like Jeff on right now is because with the Trump presidency now in for the last 2 weeks, there's been a lot of stuff happening around tariffs, which is a fundamental potential disruption to how we view supply chain globally, how we view the whole tariff thing. I'm trying to dumb it down for the audience and myself, because I, you know, Jeff is on a whole different level when it comes to this. But Jeff is going to be able to give us a ton of insights around the different things to look out for, the variables to think about, specific stories like Tesla, the auto industry, and whatever other industries we get into with Jeff. But I'm actually really excited to talk to you about this. And I know Hans is going to have a ton of incredible questions too. So let me start by sort of set the stage. So Trump is in office for 2 weeks. There's been all this stuff around tariffs. But the way I view it is a lot of it is a bargaining chip for a lot of the stuff that everybody's doing. But some of it is, it could also be legitimate because of some of the disadvantages that the U.S. has been sort of set up from a tariff perspective. It doesn't seem like we are set up where we should be. But I'm going to defer to you and kind of walk us through what you've seen so far. And I'm just going to leave it very open, because I know we can go down a bunch of different paths. So give us a lay of the land from what you're seeing so far.
And as you do that, Jeff, can you also provide, like, I think people underestimate how important supply chain is. And maybe they have felt pressure on their wallet from inflation over the past 4 years, maybe they've begun to have a little bit of a deeper understanding of why supply chain is important, which is why all this stuff is important. So if you can, help provide a little extra color there as well.
Yeah, no, great. And supply chain is a great profession. It's full of bright minds. It's full of engineers. It's chock full of engineers. People don't realize that. And I came up, you know, as an engineer in the technical route in supply chain before I went into executive management at the C-level, kind of overlooking the whole thing. It's chock full of engineering work. It's chock full of business planning, geopolitics, finance. You know, it's chock full of everything. I highly recommend it. We don't have enough in the engineering side of it, like, how do you make something? Like, what are the processes involved all the way from the raw material level all the way to the finished product? Like, we don't have enough people involved in how products are made. In this country, we've been pushing people, you know, like, write code. If you're gonna go in the sciences, like, write code. Do other forms of, like, hardware engineering, but, you know, write code, do hardware engineering. And we really, and then we stopped making factory. In fact, I worked as an engineer in like some of the last factories and like cellular infrastructure, even the first early mobile phones were the last actual we actually had factories here making phones and shipping them to, you know, before Verizon, you know, it was other, you know, it was Primeco, it was other different, names of different various companies. And AT&T and so forth, and those are less. And then we moved everything. Everything moved offshore. Everything, and especially as it related to consumer electronics. And then what happened is then you started you were doing more and more of the automobile stateside in the U.S. And then those things turned into modules. And then those things moved offshore. And then Western Europe did this. They followed the same things. And this was the, if you're just looking down, if you're looking down on Earth, like, the globalization of supply chain, nothing was made all in one country, except when you went to the landing spot for globalization, which ended up being, you know, greater parts of Asia and mostly China. So yeah, it's understood. People think supply chain is sometimes it's just like moving boxes and shipping stuff from point A to point B. And by the way, I have tremendous respect for logistics experts. In fact, a lot of the analysis involved in tariffs is really understanding import export and understanding how these things work. But that would be a really kind of dry conversation, you know, for the next hour. But yeah, it's thanks, misunderstood. Jeff. But in terms of the lay of the land, you're talking about everything that's made in these countries, and you're talking about the leverage they have in terms of what they import, what they export. And the U.S. is a net importer, and that's what's happened to our country over the last several decades. We stopped making a lot of stuff, and you have supply chain professionals all the way up to the executive level and CEO of companies saying, hey, look, I can look at the individual piece part price, and if I can look at the labor content, I can look at my automation or my capital content to build a product, and I can do all of this stuff cheaper in a place where it's, you know, 1/10 the labor cost, 1/20 the labor cost. And that's what you have happening. So with the free trade agreements and the World Trade Organization, everything kind of, there was this big movement to China. And then with NAFTA, this big move to Mexico and this big burden sharing with Mexico and Canada. And then when you step back and you look, you're like, well wait a minute. Well, what's going on here is we build an automobile. What was happening was, forget about EV versus ICE. What was happening is the high labor content items, the expensive high labor content items were moving to Mexico. And then the assembling of modules, the low labor content, the fewer number of jobs, those operations were moving to the US. And then there's gamesmanship back and forth of like, how do I get a stamp that says that I'm majority US content? How can I say I'm assembled in USA? What's the minimum criteria for me to say something like that? And that's where you kind of arrive where you're at today. But this is where it becomes interesting. If you start up your own company and you have a visionary and you have somebody that's thinking through this and they're thinking through total landed economics, you have to think about, and this is I wrote an article over the weekend. If your parts have more frequent flyer miles than your sales team, when tariff wars erupt, you're going to be in trouble.
And lo and behold,
that is a great line.
That's fantastic. If your parts have
more frequent flyer miles, I made that up too. That's true.
That's fantastic. On the spot too. Somebody make it. We'll make it into merch, and we'll give you 100% of the profits. Yeah. So how do you view the last 2 weeks then within that context, right? So there's been a ton of stuff happening around the tariff world with Trump specifically. It was something that he was running on. It's a lot of people are freaking out online, behind the scenes, all the different, like there's a lot of, like, let's put it mildly, there's a lot of uncertainty going on right now, especially with Trump's actions as of late around tariffs. We'll see, you know, what the end result looks like. Like I said before, I view it more as a negotiating tactic, but it could have somewhat fundamental disruption. So what do you think so far? Like, what do you view as far as like the key things to look at based on what we saw specifically in the last 2 weeks?
What the key things from the last 2 weeks, it should be a wake-up call for companies that this president is thinking about trade a different way. And he's not afraid to break a few things along the way. There are things that he's talked about that I'm gravely concerned about. For example, putting a tariff on Taiwan and on chip import. I'm terrified of that because what's happened, we used to make a ton of silicon and we used to have a lot of wafer fab, and we still do in the United States. But we started moving as the complexity grew. And of course, with globalization, all that industry moved to Asia as well. And so you'll hear stories about things. Oh, okay, TSMC, they're making, you know, they got a plant. It's making samples. People don't know. They think it's like it's already shipping. No, it's making samples for customers to qualify. What are those samples? They're at the wafer level. What happens after they go to the wafer? Then they have to go for tests, and they have to go for packaging. Where's the test and packaging happening? It's not in the U.S. So there's no TSMC Arizona solution this year. This year, there is no TSMC Arizona solution that produces a wafer, singulates it, tests and probes, packages the part, and ships it to, you know, let's say it were Tesla in Austin. There's no solution. Amkor Asia. So these would go back to like Amkor in Taiwan or Korea for packaging, final test, and then they would be shipped to whatever factory they're going to. So like the whole CHIPS Act, everything, I like the start of it. But to me, there should have been more hooks around the entire supply chain and every tier of the supply chain. So it's great. Like we want to bring silicon manufacturing. That's great. By the way, we don't have the workforce for it, and it's highly automated, but you still need the management, the technical management workforce for something like that. We don't have it. So TSMC is actually importing Taiwanese engineers and Taiwanese management to run TSMC Arizona. I don't know if people know that, but that's what's actually happening. So I am scared. So when you say like what's happening, what's critical, yeah, I think there's going to be some things breaking along the way. And not that a 15% tariff or whatever on silicon is going to break something per se, but it's going to start. And when you think about these AI factories that are being built, you know, Foxconn, a lot of these sub-assemblies, a lot of the rack assembly work is actually happening in Mexico. So that would have been quite the tariff, 25%. If you look at the value, the export value on those items, that would have been quite the tariff going on those. I sent a post out maybe a month or two ago. I'm like, you guys better figure out how to bring all this over the border. That's going to be a cluster if that hits and those escalate for some reason. So I think the lay of the land is this is a reality. By the way, we have a 30-day pause. Like there was no agreement like this is over. Like there's an overhang here. We have a 30-day pause. I'm assuming the Trump administration wants to see, like I see all these posts on X of like, oh, they already had the troops. This is nothing. No, we have satellite imagery. We have a military. We know we count noses. So I'm assuming they want to make sure that these governments are doing what they said they were going to do. And I'm sure they may be looking for more. I think, I don't know if there's a solution yet in terms of the imbalance in trade. And you can say like, okay, we had an agreement. And I just don't think President Trump views agreements in the same way. And you can criticize them or you can not. I'm not sure. I'm reading the USMCA now. I've read it before. I had to study it before. I'm rereading it again. And I'm just trying to understand, you know, kind of where it leaves us from a trade. Right now, Mexico and Canada export 75 to 85% of what they make to the United States. And I don't know why the USMCA would set up that much dependency, but it did. And we have very little dependency. So they're up to 25. I knew that this 25% either was not going to go on or it was going to be some sort of quick response. That initial response from Mexico and Canada to me was all PR. And in the meantime, they were like, okay, let's do phase one of a deal and let's get something over to the president, you know, Sunday night, Monday morning. I mean, there's no way it would have been disastrous. And then the next stage of disaster, and I was kind of thinking through it, and I'll come up for air here to the next question. If the tariffs went on for Mexico, I gave the U.S. auto industry and major players in it like a week, maybe even less, for factories to start shutting down. There may have been certain suppliers shutting down day one. Like, I'm like, what do I put on the invoice? Like, what number do I put in the invoice? What value can I export this at where I don't get screwed? And the final thing I'll say is, you know, there's all these like, you know, t-shirts that can be made of people trying to just have a quick tagline, have a hot take. The worst, the most inaccurate hot take on X is that the importer always pays the tariff. The importer, and I've done distribution 150, the importer is writing the check for the amount to import the product, and it has to be inclusive of the tariff amount, and it has to go over to the customs and border official. But the deal behind that is typically shared. And if people don't understand that, they're naive to like how things actually work. And that back and forth takes some time in terms of like if this happens. So I can see in this next 30 days, I can see that kind of going, like there should be war planning. And then there should also be, I think you're going to see some inventory jockeying because now there's a 30-day pause. So you could literally go pedal to the metal now, because if something, you have to bet, like, is this going to hit or not? And like, then you, do you start stocking up, and do you start importing more? Do you start exporting more? It's wild to think about. There's a lot, so many permutations.
And that's the, so it's like the way I think about that is you've had decades of a built up supply chain system that has been, like you said, centered around one specific region of the world. Like, you know, let's call it Asia, Eastern Asia ish. And then Mexico, if you want to, and you want to look at it from a US perspective specifically, but there has been a movement away from localization that has been happening for the last few decades. And then it seems like with the last couple of weeks, at least it's sort of kickstarting or disrupting that entire system. And to me, maybe tell me this is a wrong characterization. It seems like some sort of incentive or disincentive, like an incentive towards localization or a disincentive against globalization, at least from a United States perspective, to try and rejigger the supply chain systems so that they're more localized versus globalized, right? And it's like, and the thing that I'm battling with is like, how else would you do this without having this type of disruption from the last couple of weeks? If, you know, if the overarching premise is localization is localization is a good thing because you are protecting yourself against disruption from a foreign entity that you don't have any control over, really. You're just trying to deal with them. You looked at COVID and what happened during COVID, the amount of insane disruption that has done, and the amount of movement has that has created away from China, from, you know, manufacturing, supply chain, and sort of, you know, settling in that country specifically. I think we've all seen how big of a deal it is to diversify your supply chain, or at least localize your supply chain, so that you're not subject to a different party that's not you. So how much do you view the last 2 weeks as a kickstarter, the catalyst to get that movement going?
It's a great question. It definitely is. And if I were in the administration right now, the Trump administration, I would, and if I were allowed to advise on this, I'd say the following. So first off, why are we here? If it's just purely trade advantage, if it's just purely kind of like, you know, localization, a localization conversation, you don't have to put the tariff on tomorrow. And hear me out. Like, this whole conversation, I go back to wanting to put a, this thought of February 18th, putting a tariff on Taiwan. Again, this is all conjecture. Nothing's been, I mean, President Trump said, he had a conversation with Jensen, you know, not sure what we're going to do yet. But the answer to your question is in that situation with silicon, I would say, all right, January 30th, 2026, we're putting the tariff on, and it's going to be a sizable number. You got a year, basically. You got to move packaging over, silicon, you got to move it over. You got to get TSMC up. You've got to get Samsung, you know, probably expanded in all, like, I would give the OEMs and I would give their partners some time to ramp up, because these things don't happen overnight. If you put them on too early, if you're only going for, you're only doing this for trade imbalance and localization, you put them on too early, you actually may be counterproductive to GDP. You may actually may be counterproductive to productivity, because you're going to have these people, like, you're going to have stuff that just can't be built. Like, the economics don't work and they just shut down. And I don't think you want that. But I think the reason the president said these are going on Tuesday morning, he's also going after, you know, a fentanyl issue. He's going after others. So it's more complicated than that. But in the case of a case of Taiwan, in the case of chip imports, I would not do that right away. But I would say I would put it on, and I would put the date, you know, in Q1. And by the way, that will set off alarm bells, you know, fires. Like, that will be, you know, there's stuff that can't even be done by that point in time. But that is the right way to think about it. And then the final thing to just think about, I know I talked a little bit more about silicon. You have to have the home. You have to have the final tier of the supply chain for silicon. We don't make smartphones here. We don't build computers here anymore. We don't build laptops. We don't build a lot of small devices where all this kind of sub 14 nanometer silicon is going. We build automobiles, but even a lot of those motherboards are built outside of the country. So you'd have to solve for that portion in parallel. And then that can be done, I think, inside of a year. But you have to have companies start thinking about, you're going to have a big a tier one, say, hey, look, you know, I'll make it up. We're Apple. We're going to start bringing lines here in the US, and then have some sort of progressive tariff of like, look, you have to start bringing X percentage of your product lines over here. That would be a win. You would set the right expectations. You would give people time to execute. It becomes inflationary if the money supply is not under control and there's available money, and then you don't have an alternative for people. So in the case of Taiwan and silicon, you don't have an alternative for people. So it's actually going to be somewhat inflation. There's no choice. There'll be some burden sharing between the importer and then the exporter. But some of this is ultimately going to get passed on to the consumer.
Hans, let me bring you in so I don't take up 100% of Jeff's time here.
Sorry, I'm talking too long.
As much as I want to. Trust me.
So I remember that Jeffrey Sachs recently said that there was a conversation that was had at the, you know, national policy level, probably in the 1970s, that kind of happened before all of the move of all this, especially semiconductor manufacturing offshore and away from the United States. Like, what type of national policy creates this environment where the United States doesn't make semiconductors anymore? And what is it specifically that would need to change for those things to be able to come back here economically and competitively?
Yeah, it's a great point. What policies create that is there's no local content policies. There's insufficient local content policies for certain things. You could expand it. Like, we have local content policies for military production. We have some local, so there's certain things that we do and there's certain things we don't, but on like commercial consumer goods, they can come from wherever, you know, they've got to meet certain requirements inbound, but you know, starting there, but really that you do it on the tariff side. This is the thing that's just, it's just, I never understood it, you know, going up into the 2017 and in Trump 1.0, I mean, we had very light tariffs on the rest of the world. I mean, we're literally at, I think, 2.5%. If we want to bring this conversation back to cars, I think we were 2.5% inbound, and China was already like 17 going to 20, I think, for them inbound for us. What are we doing? Like, we're allowing them to build up their auto industry, ramp their auto industry, and we're saying here, auto parts, whatever, you can ship in whatever you want. Now, they were not developed as an auto industry, so the threat level was low. I get it. But even on other categories, it was the same thing. They had their static 17% VAT, and we had nothing. You know, if we wanted to ship a smartphone into Brazil, they would charge a 30 to 40% inbound tariff on that. And it basically, I mean, those were the margins, sometimes double the margins on those products, depending on the tier. So they basically set a tariff level that says, all right, you don't want to build a factory here in Brazil, then the size of the tariff is going to be all of your margins. So figure out if, you know, if those economics work for you, great. If not, you know, you better come down here and build a factory. So what everybody do, they came down to Brazil and they made a factory. And that's what happened. And some companies, you know, they didn't, and just, they were able to raise their prices and just, you know, muscle through it. But the world had tariffs on the US. And that was another reason why a lot of our manufacturing just was siphoned out of here. And the other thing is, people just, again, you have financial people, accounting people looking down at the books and saying, wow, I can get this widget for 75 cents if it's made in China. And then I look at the total, you know, and sometimes they're not looking at total landed costs and logistics and so forth. But with innovations and with just the cargo fleet and everything and all that capacity expanding over decades, like it was all figured out. Like, it was all like, wow, you can get the economics to work where you basically build everything there and ship it here. So yeah, it'd have to start with, you know, things around local content and tariffs. But I think what we have to figure out is like, what is a vision of end state? Like, what do we want to do? Do we want to build everything? I don't think the answer is we want to build everything. So I think we have to figure out what we want to build. What are those future technologies? Like, do we want to own humanoids? Do we want to own hardware as close to AI as possible? You know, what are the things that we ultimately want to own? That's where we should. I don't think we should be focused on televisions, quite frankly. I don't think we should be focused on, we lost those things. By the way, we just totally lost those things. We had a huge television supply chain. We had again, we had a mobile phone supply chain here in the United States. We had it. In fact, I was one of the first partners. We were building up this smartphone, or sorry, this phone for the US. It was one of the, you know, Motorola's known for clam phones. I worked for Motorola, and we were this whole full metallic clam phone in 2000, and supply chain here was definitely getting stressed out, but we had the whole thing mapped out here. It's titanium knuckles and aircraft grade aluminum. We had the whole thing mapped out. And then, you know, this guy that was making television knobs and parts for TVs named Terry Gao in Taiwan approaches and said, "Hey, we think we can help you. Do you want to work with us on we'll help you build out your supply chain?" And that was the start of Foxconn and mobile phones. And it's just the entrepreneurial capabilities of them were just unbelievable. And then these were many like Taiwanese, Singaporean, Malaysian leaders, some Chinese leaders, but then they all coalesced and said, "We can get you set up in China and really take your cost structure down." And that's where kind of, you know, things started for some industries. So yeah, long answer, but it's kind of wild when you think about the history of things. But the fact that we weren't tariffing a lot of people and everybody was tariffing us, that was part of the driving force.
Yeah, I mean, I hear that critique from a lot of people, especially from, you know, people who would share the libertarian camp with me, but, you know, just a lot of people in general, that, you know, free trade is obviously better. When you put on tariffs, you're basically hurting yourself. It's a self-inflicted wound. But I think that people lose sight of the fact that if you, like, there are other people making their own decisions, and not everyone, like, just because we as the United States can try and lead into this, you know, free market economy vision of the future where there's no tariffs anyone in any way, and we do that, if other people don't then respond and match that policy, then you're not in this ideal free market world that people suppose. Like, if the United States is not imposing tariffs, then the world is a free market world. And that's just not the case, because other people have their own tariffs. And then it does, like, yes, the automobile supply chain in Southeast Asia was not a threat to us when we started this. But after, you know, within the last 10 years, they definitely became a massive threat. And then if you listen to people like Michael Dunn, he believes that, you know, outside of major structural changes in trade policy, that the United States is basically all the Western legacy automakers are done for, because the Asia Pacific automakers are just going to run away with it. And it's because we gave them, you know, a giant structural advantage. Not only, you know, it's like, there's lots of smart people all over the world, Taiwan and China and Malaysia included, but also here in the United States. But if we give them, you know, a 20-point lead on us and 30 years, well, that is an advantage that compounds over time. And eventually you find yourself in a situation like we're in today, where our industry is then in serious peril. And it's because we didn't think about the long-term impacts of us allowing free trade with other partners, but them not reciprocating.
Yeah. It's very disarming. It's very cool. It's very comfortable to say, "I'm a free trader, dude. Like, I'm a free trader. I'm a free trader. I want free trade." The problem is the other side isn't doing it. And when the other side isn't doing it, it's not so cool. So if you want to, like, it's a kind of a cool thing to say, but when the other side isn't doing it, you're getting screwed. And that's ultimately what was happening in many situations. Now, these trade agreements are complex. You can't just look at, you know, we charge Canada this for dairy, they charge us, they're screwing us. You kind of have to look at the whole thing. And I, trust me, I've gone through these things. I understand it. But on the whole, a lot of this thing was set up, it was a complete kind of screw job. And I mean, people can have good intentions when they're sitting down to make a deal, but they're just not good, or they're not smart at making a deal, and kind of like, where does the country want to go? And again, the country a couple of decades wasn't going towards, man, we want to build more shit. We want to build more stuff. Like, we want to, now we're like, we're going to write software for everything. We want to be in services. Like, we want to do, that's what we want. That's all the stuff we want to do. And part of that was a good thing. But, you know, the everything's coming back to, even with AI, like, your discernible lead with AI is going to be, is can you make the AI brain, and can you make the shit that puts it into the real world and creates value for people? And if you can only do one part of that and you can't do the other, your value is probably going to be a fraction of what it could be. And that's why I bring it back to Tesla. And I come back to this tariff conversation. If you want to go back into automobiles for a minute.
Please, yeah.
It's crazy. There's a culture. There's a strategy and a culture inside of Tesla that built them for this moment. It also built them for geopolitical, even kinetic issues. It's built them for this moment. And why do I say, like, give me specific example. Let me give you specific examples. One thing people realize is, like, when they pull their door sticker off their new Model Y and they'll look at it and be like, oh my God, there's a percentage of parts that are coming from Mexico. What's going on? I thought these cars were made in the US. First thing you start off, you design, like, where is my, it's called in the supply chain design, where is my source of supply? And when you say source of supply, that term means is, where is the factory that product comes out the back that goes to a customer? So you start with your source of supply. That's the center of the world. And there's certain people, and this is where people get tripped up. They're like, oh my God, there's 20 or 30% of the parts that are, you know, they're coming from Mexico. The key thing, the higher order bit with tariffs, is not the percent of parts. It's the percent of cost. And it's the percent of the bill of material and the transformation of that bill of material expressed in cost. Okay. And this is where Tesla, by the way, Rivian, by the way, Lucid as well, are positioned very well. Now, Tesla's in a different league, I would say. They both copied a lot of what Tesla's doing, probably out of necessity. Tesla's in a different league because here's what happens. So Tesla's electric motors, inverters, battery packs, these high dollar, high complexity items are made in the factory that Tesla builds the vehicle, or call it, you know, pseudo next door, you know, Nevada to Fremont, so forth. You know, there's some of that, but essentially you have this core. You go back to your source of supply. Everything coming out of Fremont, everything coming out of Austin is going into the United States. Then you start expanding to tier one in the supply chain, and you start seeing, and that tier one is like this thing that's orbiting around the source of supply. And what did Tesla do? They took all the high dollar items in tier one and they pulled them into the factory. Part of it was because of they have IP over it. They can build an electric motor better, efficient, and so forth. They have IP around things. And then part of it is actually, I think, built for these kind of situations as well. So when a tariff, let's say, and not to, and I'll come up for air here, let's say GM and Tesla had final assembly in the United States, and they both had a 25% import on GM and a 25% import on Tesla. The two aren't equal, and here's why. The high dollar items, we call them high insertion, or we call them, you know, just high direct labor content, percent direct labor content. They move that stuff down to Mexico because that's the sub $16 an hour place to do that activity, and not the $50 an hour place up in the United States. By the way, all of the union negotiations to like ratchet prices up drive more content down to Mexico. The more that they were doing that, nobody looks at, okay, what is the resultant effect and the net number of new jobs from doing that? So it'd be interesting if like the unions would actually expose, like, they probably have less net dollars and less net membership as a result of what they're pushing for. Like, you can only push, there should be an equation around how much you can push those labor rates before you start losing more and more parts. And they were losing parts. Okay. So back to my example, a 75% GM assembled car in the US and a 75% assembled Tesla's going to have all those high dollar items in it. They're not going to be importing them. Tesla's going to be importing wire harnesses. They're going to be importing things like that. So when the tariff goes on, the tariff's going on a $4 part and it's making it $5. When the tariff goes on the engine, by the way, they have parts where they're adding value in Mexico, they're bringing it back to a supplier in Texas or in New Mexico, then they're sending it back over the border to do another step. There's parts that they have, these high dollar parts that come over multiple times. So they're just not built equally. Tariff or not, Tesla has the high value parts co-located with their factory. So yes, Tesla would have an impact, but it would be a small dollar impact. And the other thing is Tesla has very high volume, low model count. So if you're a supplier and you say, oh, look, I got this Model Y part, they want me to move it from Mexico to the US, and Model Y, you look, GM asked me to do X, Y, and Z. Well, GM's got 30 models. Tesla's got this one with all the volume. I'm going to put my people, in terms of my queue of jobs, I'm going to go do the Tesla job and get it done. Because if I don't get it done, I may lose the part.
That's incredibly insightful, right? Because I think one of the biggest things, the debate that I've seen specifically around the Tesla story, is that these Trump tariffs are going to be extremely painful for Tesla. And even though they might incur some higher costs, the totality of the impact of the entire auto industry actually puts them in a significantly better spot, because so much of their stuff is made yes. here. And they're high dollar stuff. The stuff, the batteries, the drivetrains, half or more of the cost in the car is made in the United States, whereas everybody else, the legacy automakers specifically, that doesn't apply to them. I think
Dozens of models that are assembled, full models that are assembled in Mexico and Canada. Like Kia has two products, the RAV, a lot of the RAV4s for the US, a big volume runner for Toyota made in Canada. There's Sierra models, there's Bronco models, not all of them, but Lincoln models, and of course the Mach-E is all made in. So yeah, let's take apart the Mach-E. Let's say that, I mean, we know that all in Ford's costs are near, $70,000-$90,000 to build that thing, but let's say we take the fixed costs out of it, and let's say net of fixed costs that, it's $40,000+ for them to build it. Well, if the 25% tariff goes on, that takes away that 10K. I mean, they were already at, like, why am I building this thing? But it's another nail in the coffin. So when or if the tariffs hit, the other automakers have two barriers to deal with. One is, first off, they'd have to have a hoard of cash that they can literally go pay and bribe suppliers, say, keep shipping, keep going, keep going, keep going. The second thing is you're just going to have suppliers that are going to stop. So they're going to run into two problems. They're going to run into a supply continuity problem, one. Two, they're going to run into a money problem of like in terms of just the value add on the bill of materials are going to go through the roof. The third thing is even if they had to go put a blitz team together and say, all right, we're going to requalify and move a bunch of this stuff to the US. Back to our original conversation from 5 minutes ago. The high complexity stuff, they moved down there because it had more of a labor content. So it's actually going to be a harder thing for them to requalify in the US. The lesser complex stuff, Tesla moved down over the border for them. So it's going to be easier for them to qual, and they have the volume per SKU advantage. So this is why I just think, am I pro Tesla? Am I long Tesla? Yes. But these are just, if somebody came in to have me look at the situation net of any, thoughts on one versus another, this is how I would analyze the situation. And they've really, Tesla gets almost no value for their supply chain, their ability to drive their COGS program. It goes all the way through engineering. It goes all the way up to the CEO. They almost get no value for that. But there's a reason they're sitting here today, and then they're the only known auto manufacturer with fixed cost that can produce a profitable EV.
Why don't people recognize their supply chain anti-fragility, to use a Nassim Taleb term, after what we saw in COVID, where they were the quickest to respond, the most flexible, the most able to deal with all of the challenges and supply shocks? I just don't understand why people forgot that.
Yeah, I mean, Gartner's a major supply chain rating consulting firm. It's kind of a handshake between the OEM and Gartner, if they're going to work together and they're going to start exposing and trading information together. So it's kind of a little bit like that. But Tesla was the 14th ranked supply chain in the world on Gartner's top 25, and there were no auto manufacturers above them. In fact, in their top 50, I think Toyota was number 40. Now, I think the list changed in 2024, but that's kind of there's a little bit of like, you know, hey, you want to get on this list of ratings of supply chain. But then the other answer to your question, you're more thinking about probably is like, why do analysts not think of it? Well, I mean, we went through an earnings call where Tesla said, hey, we're going to be supply constrained in 2025. Oh, by the way, there's these tariffs coming on. And none of the analysts asked a question about why are you supply constrained and what are you doing about it? And what number are you supply constrained to? And then none of them followed up and said, hey, President Trump's been talking about putting 25% tariffs. What does that do to your business? Help us understand it. Nobody asked about it. So there's a void in the analyst community. I love some of them and they're great. There's just a void of like, not an understanding of the implications of supply chain and the value of the company.
I think so, you know, just like you, I am a long Tesla investor, all that good stuff. I think the thing that I can't escape is that the separation between Tesla and the, let's say, the Western car competition. I think China is a whole different story, right? Because China has a heavily subsidized auto industry that's making some legitimately great products, but it's tough to understand what their cost structure is. Are they actually profitable? Their safety, you know, there's a host of other things.
They're not paying suppliers on time.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. By the way, if you're walking up to the patient and you're trying to understand, like, what are the vital signs? And in this case, the patient is a company that makes something. The first thing you want to understand is like, what's their inventory position? And the second thing you want to understand is like, are they paying their suppliers? And what's their accounts receivable look like? And I'm telling you, and I've been telling people this for almost a year, something's going on in China. They're not paying. I mean, it's not so much that the days payable are different between the US, because they are. Tesla's at 60 some or like low 60 days in the US to pay their suppliers, and they're like at 90 in China. So there's definitely an offset. There's definitely an understanding in China. But what you have to look at is the yearly progression. And what Tesla has done over the last couple of years is they went from 120 to 110 to 100 to 90 or something. That's where they're at right now. They've been coming down. The BYDs, the NIOs of the world have ballooned. They're all the way up at like 250 to 70 days of
is it really that bad?
Yeah. And I was not aware. Yeah. Well, I mean, we have a media that doesn't like to go into this, although I will give Bloomberg credit. They did do a story on this. It just doesn't get picked up. Like, people understand, like, the patient is sick, like something is wrong.
Okay. So as Chamath would say, let's double click on this. So what is going on? Let me take a guess and then you tell me if I'm going down the right path. So for a long time, it's been dubious if the Chinese automakers were actually making these cars profitably. The only reason why you would be so late in paying your suppliers is because you don't have enough funds to pay them, right? I mean, what else would be going on here? And so that reinforces the fact that even though the Chinese manufacturing system is creating a lot of cars that are specifically electric vehicles, who knows how much they're being subsidized. When it comes to the suppliers, they're not seeing they're building stuff for the Chinese automakers, but they're not getting paid. So the only thing that could be happening here is that these automakers don't have the money to pay them, right? Even if they're being subsidized, they don't have the money to pay their suppliers, which paints a really grim picture. At some point, something's going to break, right? At some point, you're going to have to say, okay, we can't make these anymore. We have to dramatically lower production, or we need the government to subsidize even heavier, right? Am I going down the right path? Am I simplifying it too much?
Partly.
Help us understand.
Yeah, partly. Well, this is where it gets weird and twisted. Not only are they're paying their suppliers in net aggregate later, but what they're also doing is they've set up funding and financing agreements between the OEM and the supplier, where they're actually funding the supplier. Like, the supplier's like, like, I mean, you have to just like, we have to do business where I make a part, you pay me. I make a part, you pay me. And then that's how the whole cash conversion cycle is created. But it's broken. I'll use BYD or name any other China OEM. Part of it is the CCP funding, but part of it, and we don't know to the extent of what that is. We just know it's there. But then part of it is the OEM themselves financing the supply and setting up financing terms. In the U.S., if you work with a U.S. OEM, whether it's in auto or whether it's in like consumer electronics, like you want to be onboarded. I've been onboarded. I've been on the OEM side and I've been on the supplier side. And it's a very grueling process to understand what are you building, who do you ship to, and are you healthy? Like there's a health portion of being onboarded as a supplier. And in China, and by the way, I'm not anti-China. I've run a supply chain in China. Like I have good understanding of it. I have a good appreciation for the people. Yeah. I have a good understanding. I'm not anti-China. I'm just saying, like in this case of automobiles, none of us knows. The other thing, when people start reporting on BYD and they're like, BYD, they're going to be the EV king. Like, oh, okay. Has anybody looked at stock and channel? Like, is it healthy? Do we know? Like how many cars are at dealers? How much inventory do they have in their factory? Is anybody looking at those health? We don't know. And it wouldn't be the first time that a company in China or a company in country X shipped a bunch of shit, built and shipped a bunch of stuff and splashed onto the screen only to light themselves on fire, whether it's months or years later of just taking on too much inventory and just kind of having this facade of like, we have an amazing business. But this isn't a conspiracy theory. Someone needs to go in and answer the question. Do we understand stock and channel for these OEMs? One, so we understand their inventory position because we see the sales numbers. Okay. And then, by the way, we don't know if those sales are to intermediate locations or they to end consumers, but we see it. But we don't know the stock and channel. And now we see their payment terms have been expanding since COVID, since 2021. They've been adding upwards of 4 to 6 weeks every year to payment. These are catastrophic numbers. Back to the U.S., like Ford and GM, even with all of their issues, they're still in the upper 50s, low 60s for maybe upper 60s, I think, GM for days payable to their suppliers. So there's something going on here. And again, it's not clean. It's not like these suppliers either self-fund or they go to the CCP for money. There's also this funding loop that's going back and forth between the OEM and the supplier. And there's this investment going on. And it's beyond, there's investment going back and forth between supplier and OEM all the time, like CapEx. I think it's beyond that. And we'll just have to see what's happening. But I think back to like, why did we get on this topic? We're just trying to understand, like, are we competing on a level playing field? And I just have a completely different theory about the kind of what's going to happen with China auto in the world. The companies that I would be watching very closely is Xiaomi. And I've competed against Xiaomi in the mobile phone world. They are spectacular. Their CEO is smart. They entered the car business with one model. And they also, the way they built that model, you're seeing the videos online. It looks like it's 100%, nothing's 100% automated, but a high amount of automation. They are the antithesis to how some of the other major Chinese automakers make cars. Very high labor intent, very high labor content. I think BYD is across a million employees, by the way, here pretty soon. So very high labor content. And my theory is, not my theory, it's just regular like knowledge of like how stuff's made. That very high labor content manufacturing process is going to be next to impossible for them to export and localize in Western Europe or the United States and be profitable. Xiaomi, on the other hand, highly automated, you can go duplicate that automation. You have less layer content at the higher labor level in the US. They could potentially do it. So, and you don't have so many models. So you've got kind of concentration with your supply base. So my theory on the whole China taking over the world thing, there are a couple to look out for. The next one I'd look out for is Li Auto. But it's not the top two or three that people always talk about in China. I think it's different companies.
Hans, I saw you came off mute. Did you want to?
So I guess to go back to BYD for just a second, I think you were hinting at the possibility that there's also some shenanigans in, you know, not only are there some possible shenanigans backwards in the supply chain, but also forwards to the whoever's selling those cars to the end consumers. And I just was thinking about the math of, you know, usually if you're a high growth company, if you have payment terms where you're getting paid by your customers before you're paying suppliers, then the faster you grow, the faster you're actually like your cash flow positive and you're benefiting, versus if you are paying your suppliers before you're getting paid by your customers, the faster you grow, the more money you waste. And just based on looking at the overall like sniff testing BYD, they seem like they're growing really fast. If they're growing really fast, why are they having to extend their payment terms with their suppliers? They're actually getting paid by their customers. And so I think this lends credence to the idea that they're probably not actually, money's not flowing from consumers into BYD faster than they're paying their suppliers. Otherwise, their cash position would be
I don't know if there's anything nefarious happening at all. It definitely, in terms of when they sell a vehicle, they sell a vehicle. I'm not saying that. Where they could be struggling is as they globalize, those number of days from, again, they're making parts and sub-assemblies in China, or they're making the whole car and then they export it and they put it on a boat. It depends on the terms they have with the importer. If they have like if they have terms of like the importer takes they take ownership at the point of export from China before it gets on the boat, then they're okay. But some of these importers have leverage based on the size of their distribution network, and maybe they'll take ownership either when it's received in their host country or maybe even when they sell it to a particular person. And BYD could be getting in trouble there as they go more global. I'm not sure. All I know is when I look at the data from 2021, this is online too. I can probably republish a post on it. Bloomberg, others have done write-ups on it. It's expanding every year. As the company expanded, their payment terms are expanding. So something's going on. And then just the other big thing we don't know with BYD is what the hell's going on in channel. Like what's the size of the channel? How old is the channel? You know, how quickly are they turning the channel? Yeah, and the thing you describe, Hans, is called the cash conversion cycle in supply chain or finance lingo. And that's basically is how quickly are you receiving payment for the good you made to the time you actually have to pay your suppliers for what you received. So if you're really good at this, and Tesla is really good at this, they may be the best, to be honest with you. You're trying to drive the cash conversion cycle to a very short number of days. If it's a short number of days, very short number of days, that means you have very little time between somebody writing the check and wiring their money for their Tesla and all the parts that went in that Tesla that you have to go and aggregate and pay your suppliers for. And as you crunch that time down, you turn your company into an ATM. And as you expand it, you become the ATM. And that's the difference. And that's where companies blow themselves up and they get into real trouble. And I will bring this back full circle to Tesla's Q4. And I call this like a couple. At some point in Q4, Tesla realized that they're not going to get to the 515K number. They know it. Okay. And they also looked forward and they said that new Model Y, it's on track, like the new product's coming in. And one of the things that Tesla is really good about, and in one of the most destructive things in unit economics that could crush your product in economics and it could crush your balance sheet, is called excess and obsolescence. Is when you have too much stuff in the channel, you got to pay price protection on it, or you have stuff at suppliers or stuff in the channel that has been canceled out because the new stuff is on the way and you need more of the new stuff. Tesla's masterful at this transition. So at some point in the quarter, they said, we're not going to go for that number. We're not going to get it. I want the stock and channel to be as close to zero as possible on the Model Y. You're not going to get it to zero. But they took their stock and channel to such a low level. They took it beyond the threshold And what supply chain people measure, they measure in stock percentage. This would be the probability of you being able to walk into a Tesla center anywhere in the country and drive off with a car within that day or a day or two. And they took that probability way below the threshold of being able to sell more cars at the velocity they normally need to sell at. I hope I'm explaining this in a way that's understandable. There is the days of inventory going down to 12 versus being up at 18 or 20 or 22 or 20. I'd be fine with 25. Because many of those days are actually transit days from it leaving the factory to it arriving to a point where it can actually be purchased. But the point is Tesla took that number down so low that they actually dampened their ability to have their normal sellout level in those last couple of weeks. And that's why the 495K number, to Tesla, what was more important was the cash position. By going from 18 to 12 days, they created $1.4 billion of cash. And they didn't make a number for analysts to clap back and forth on. They don't give a shit. They want the cash. They want the money. And that's the decision they made. And they knew the Model Y was coming. That's how the whole thing, I'm 1000% sure that's the decisions they made.
So let me jump in here. I'm just hearing that Tesla is the only car company that's positioned well for the next 2 years. A lot of the Chinese automakers are struggling from a supply chain perspective, to pay the suppliers, which there's something going on. We're not really sure yet. There's a few players that might survive, but those players are not really at the volumes of your BYDs or your Teslas. I think Xiaomi makes like 100,000 cars per year or something.
They're just getting started, but Xiaomi and Li Auto, I would say that they're in a decent spot. In fact, Li Auto is bringing their days payable down. I haven't seen the Xiaomi numbers, but they've actually been bringing, they're higher. They're much higher than Tesla, but they've been bringing them down. Actually, the founder of Li Auto was my former colleague, Lenovo. Okay. I know him very well. So that Li Auto was built partly by, a very smart person on the technology and automobile side and a very smart person on the supply chain side.
Yeah. So there's a few players in China, Xiaomi, Li Auto, maybe a couple others that are well positioned to move into the next back half of this decade, let's say. Tesla seems obviously extremely well positioned because of how they've set up their supply chain, their localization efforts. They got the best-selling car, which has just been refreshed, which would probably improve margins. And they're working on FSD, all that stuff. Like, that's a whole different disruption. Then you have the legacy auto equation where, regardless of what happens with this tariff discussion, just by the virtue of not having the same advantages that Tesla has that we've all known about, they are on a downward spiral when it comes to being able to keep up. To me, it feels like the back half of this decade, something's going to break with the auto industry. There's going to be a cataclysmic event of some sort. We've talked about the Valley of Death. Many times on this channel, sort of a concept that is applied to the transition away from the gas car to the electric vehicle, where you're going to have this situation where as we make that transition, the old guard dies off, but there's not enough supply of the new guard to plug in the hole. And so you're going to have a net reduction of supply for automobiles, period. It just so happens that it seems to be aligning with the advent of autonomy at scale, right?
Yeah.
So is this actually happening? Is this the Ron Paul meme of like, it's happening? Is the auto industry, and I don't want to paint it in a positive manner at all, but because a lot of jobs are going to be impacted by this, a lot of lives are going to be impacted by this, a lot of industries are going to be impacted by this. But to me, it feels like we are walking, we have officially crossed the chasm, and we are walking, and we're accelerating towards the complete and utter destruction of what was and a rebirth of what is. Is that a fair characterization?
Yeah, mostly. I would throw Toyota in there as having a chance. And the reason they have a chance is they probably have one of the top three supply chains in auto, especially on the supply base side. And they do a really good job at inventory, given how much they manufacture. So I would throw Toyota in there, Tesla, and a couple of the China automakers in there. I don't know. I mean, somebody on the Western European side, I don't know. I mean, they're going to have to reinvent themselves. You may see a lot of mergers happening. You're already starting to see that. That's going to be the next phase is like, okay, we can't survive on our own.
Consolidation.
So let's go do a joint venture. By the way, we already went through that phase. We did joint ventures in China. Okay, those are starting to like not, they're whatever. Okay. Well, let's have China come in and start taking some of our manufacturing space. We'll allow that. And then all of a sudden, then you're going to see brands wholesale merge and say like, hey, you know, you plus me, we have these, you know, complementary skills. Let's figure it out. The problem is what are they chasing? And they're not chasing something that's not moving. They're, you know, Tesla is not standing still. The next vehicles are going to take another leg down in COGS. And you're at a critical point already where an EV now can be made more profitably or equivalently profitably, but at the same average transaction price of an ICE vehicle. And as long as EV growth continues, and as long as I think we are going to see some supply disruptions along the way, but it's not going to be smooth sailing. You're not going to have this glut of cell supply and material supply for batteries. I think you're going to see some hiccups, but in general, the number is going to go lower. But, and by the way, I can speak to what I think is happening with Tesla. And I've talked about this for the last couple of months too, with battery supply, but yeah, I think it is shaping up that way. I would throw Toyota into the mix as a most likely survivor, and this will play out. And by the way, the other thing, Farzad, that we just will never know is like, is there, you know, a card that's going to be thrown in from each of these governments saying, we cannot let you fail. And here's a helicopter full of money. We saw the bailouts in 2009. And then what you've had happen over the last two or three years is through the Department of Energy, they've literally given them like $30 billion for EV line conversion and for investments in battery manufacturing. And I would say the return on that is near zero. And it may amount to not much more than zero. Maybe it's going to be something. But man, if Doge or somebody wanted to go in and audit and say, all right, you got this money 2 years ago, what the hell have you done with it? That would be an interesting
thing. Giving it to their investors.
Obviously, it'd be like plutonium for Elon to go in and start looking at EV investments from the government. But anyway.
Go for it, Hans. We have you back.
So the question that I had earlier on Tesla's cash conservatism is, you know, how important is that for this moment in time where we do have these trade uncertainties? And exactly. How are they positioned relative to other players when it comes to cash?
Yeah, I don't have the full spreadsheet in front of me, but the, you know, growing this cash pile over the last year, they probably added $7-8 billion or more, and they just keep growing it every year. And they've basically shown this propensity of like, yeah, we could have EV growth come to a stall in the United States and in Europe, and we're still generating free cash. And to me, that's one of the superpowers of the company, and it sets them up for this investment in AI. It sets them up for the next kind of leg of investment. If they have to invest in humanoids, they may have to do a huge investment, you know, in humanoids. It sets them up in just a phenomenal position as it relates to cash. But other auto companies, they're generating cash, but you just look at their debt level and you wonder like, well, how does this all play out? Interest rates really high. How much does it cost for them to finance this debt? And like, where's that going? By the way, I'm not the one sitting here saying that, you know, everybody's going out of business in a year, nor is anybody on this panel saying that. But like I said, you could have government intervention things playing out. I just think Tesla's almost set themselves up with a fortress balance sheet. Tesla doesn't care if the gross margins are 13 or 18. Right now, it doesn't matter because they're preparing themselves for this next wave with autonomy and humanoids. I think they want to generate free cash every quarter. I don't think that they want to let this go out of control or off the rails. And that's why you see them raising prices in areas. You see them, you know, price stability has actually been quite good. And you see this aggressive COGS program. You know, you bring on this expensive Cybertrucks and still their net COGS are going down quarter on quarter, even after adding that thing into the mix. So I think they're still very serious about it. And I think they just built up a very strong balance sheet. And again, I think what analysts seem to get over is it's not, you know, don't like hyperventilate about, you know, they beat gross margins in the last quarter and we were all celebrating. The point is, I think it's going to be up and down. It's going to be, but it's going to be in this small window. And then the revenue, it's going to be a small window, plus or minus a couple, $100 million. Fine. Okay. They're setting up for the next wave, which is autonomy.
So speaking of the next wave, let's get into the really juicy section. So we know that we're in a competition with China right now on a number of fronts, and China's kind of a rising global power. We're not sure what's going on here in the United States. Hopefully we're not a declining global power. And there's autonomy, AI, and robotics are going to be huge technology platforms that define, who are the most powerful nations in the future. And bringing the conversation that we've had together, there's a lot of economic reasons why a lot of the supply chains for those things don't exist here in the United States. And that puts us at a structural disadvantage in some ways. And so if you were, I want you to role play two things. First, if you were president of the United States today and you had to make policy decisions to put the United States in a place to have the supply chain security to protect national security on these issues, what does your decision matrix look like? How are you trying to position the U.S. well for that? What are your goals? And then from there, okay, then if you're Elon and you're trying to run Tesla in that environment, then how do you position yourself?
What I want to do is I want to pick the industries that we're going to win in. You can't say you're going to win in everything. Like I said, we don't want to win in TVs anymore. We don't want to win in certain things. But we want to pick the industries we want to win in, and then we want to go build a strategy from the raw material level, from literally pulling it out of the earth, to all the way to the end distribution model of how is the product going to get to the consumer. And so there's things that the government can do. The government needs to enable that. They need to enable a trade relationship that allows it. And then we need private companies, though, that are thinking through that whole thing end to end. What would be great is if there was another end to end vertically integrated company like Tesla thinking through this. I love some of the bot companies and what they're trying to do and what they're building and the energy behind it. The demos are great. But I always kind of think through end state of man, is this going to be through acquisition? How are they going to build this thing? Where's the brain power in terms of getting this thing built? And then I look at the fundamental model of, are they making the silicon, or, did they design the silicon for the AI brain, or are they buying it from somebody else? Do they write the software for the AI brain, the layer one, the operating system for it, and then the software, or are they getting it from someone else? And if you just get your blank sheet of paper and say, I'm going to build the business plan, the unit economics are building this thing, I'm going to look at who the hell am I, okay, if it works and it's amazing, you can charge whatever you want for it, and it's not going to be a big deal in the first couple of years. But when you want to start competing on a global stage and making tens of millions of these things, you have to get the unit economics right. And those are multi-year decisions that should have been made in advance. This is why, when we start putting in all the EV, the Department of Energy stuff, I applaud what they were doing. For who cares what administration they're in? I kind of applaud what they're doing. The problem is China was doing that, 10, 12 years prior to that. And we've already lost the mineral war. We lost the refining war. There's so many of these wars that we actually lost already. And so if I'm the next or I'm the current administration, I'm getting the business leaders in. I'm getting a portion of my government to get together. Not so much that the government's going to design the supply chain, but the government's going to enable some of these really good partners, private partners, to be successful. So you got to think minerals all the way up to the end distribution model of product. And then regulatory is the other thing. You can't have a regulatory framework that takes that extends the schedule of designing and developing these things. You have to let these companies build, but you have to have a light framework that's safety focused on AI, safety focused on the physical form of the humanoid robots. And you have to have people involved in the regulatory framework that are builders, that are people involved in making product. And then I think it can all work, but you got to have all those things working together. The from the minerals to the distribution model, and then the regulatory framework, those things all have to be working together. By the way, this is when people ask me like, oh, are you concerned like Elon and government and he's involved? I actually feel better. Could you imagine, like, I always think like there's three things that Elon's got to do. He's got to work in from a government perspective. He's got to get an AI regulatory framework in, one. Two, he's got to get a federal autonomy framework. Imagine trying to launch robotaxi into 50 different regulatory frameworks because we have 50 different states. The third thing is he's got to get a regulatory framework around freestanding walking humanoid robots and how that will integrate into the workforce and into human life. And if he wasn't there, I could only imagine Tesla could have done some of the best private company work on the planet, and it could have never been allowed to scale. So you actually need these two entities working together. So net of the risk and net of all the bombastic whatever stuff that's going back and forth, if he wasn't there, the Tesla business actually would have been limited and potentially screwed if he wasn't doing what he's going to be doing in government. Now, am I sitting there saying that Elon sitting in government and making a regulatory framework for Tesla? No, he's going to help at least guide the process for the whole industry. And I mean, if you look at these, like he's not saying a word about tariffs. He's staying away from all these things. And, you know, there's a very kind of sensitivity around all that, but yeah, long answer is you got to be minerals to the distribution model, and you got to have a regulatory framework that works. That's what governments can be doing right now.
Yeah, it does seem like if for the United States to be well positioned for the next couple of decades, they have to be at the frontier of the most fundamental changes in industry. And a lot of that is going to be driven through automation, artificial intelligence specifically, and something like self-driving cars and humanoid robots are right up that alley. I mean, there's so many other different products and services that could be birthed out of that that we can't even picture today that are enabled by those technologies. But I do think, and it's just so interesting that you have that individual that could create those frameworks. Like anybody that would be in autonomy and humanoid robots would win so hard in the United States if that gets passed, right?
Yeah, everybody can compete.
Exactly, everybody can compete. It's going to make everybody better. The consumer is going to win first and foremost because you're going to have competition and you're going to have life-changing technologies that are going to open up so much bandwidth for individuals. Self-driving cars are going to give you all your time back. We can talk about, oh my God, I can't control the car anymore. Okay, cool. You're not going to die anymore on the road. So that's one benefit, but let's discuss the pros and cons. And then the human or robot takes that to a completely different level as far as freeing up people's time. Then you open the Pandora's box of what are we going to do with our time and labor and blah, blah, blah. Of course, extremely important discussion, but that's where we're going anyway. Like China's going to do that, you know? I don't know what Europe's doing, but at some point, hopefully they wake up and they're going to do that, right? The rest of the world, this is where we're heading. And so it's incredibly important for the United States to be a leader in that area if they want to retain their position as the world's most powerful economy and most powerful military. You have to do that through industry. If you don't do that through industry, you're going to be left behind. You will lose your ability to stay competitive with the rest of the world.
Yeah, and the other reason to have Elon where he is on the regulatory framework. And this is why this, you know, you have to, you know, kill 10 regulations to put one new one in is so important. This is the balance between export restrictions on silicon and regulatory. I would much rather have us knocking out the 10 requirements than putting another export thing like to lock China. If you think we're locking China out of competition, you're not. Look at what happened in Singapore. Look what happened with the gray market. You talk to anybody in the industry, when these export restrictions are going on silicon, you're like, are you crazy? There's no way that they're going to be able to control this. And if they want it, they're going to be able to get it. But you're better off, and you're better off in not trying to put handcuffs on everyone else. You're better off in trying to take the handcuffs off your own people, because we have the people from all over the world, but we have the people in the United States that we could actually out-innovate. That's how we're going to win, is we out-innovate without all these handcuffs on. That's, to me, a greater force than trying to lock everybody else out.
No, love it. We've got about 6 minutes here. Hans, did you want to throw something in before we want to make sure Jeff? Okay, perfect.
Very thorough conversation.
Dude, it felt like we were just getting started. Yeah. Yeah, dude. Okay. Where can people find you? Talk about everything that, your socials, anything else you want to throw in there, please.
Yeah, no, just, I mean, I'm an X, that's fine. Just, you know, I'm not, you know, that's the best place. I think one place to find me. I think that's great. I appear on some other, I like talking about this stuff and how it impacts the industry. And I find it fascinating. I also find people that want to debate me and say, you know, you're stupid. You don't know what you're talking about. I love those too. Bring it on. We'll have the conversation. I'm sure. I mean, there's things I usually learn a lot sometimes for if the people, you know, if they have a competent other side of it, it's great too. So I love talking about these concepts, but yeah, Axe is great.
Awesome. At the Jeff Lutz, we'll put a link for that in the description, in the comment section below. Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate you.
Yeah. Be nice.
It was an honor. Yeah. Oh, they're going to be nice. Don't worry. They'll be nice.
They're always nice. I hope.